Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
I'm Marcus Peter. We are beginning today by talking about. Firstly, with Andrea Picciotti Bear. Last Sunday at Cities in St. Paul, Minnesota, worshippers opened their Bibles and began to pray. It was not part of the plant service. It was their response to an anti-ICE mob that had stormed into their sanctuary, disrupting their constitutional right to worship freely. Now, this wasn't an isolated incident. In fact, it's becoming part of a pattern. And that pattern is emerging. It's going to keep growing, and we have a problem. We're going to be joined by Andrea Picciotti Bear to talk about this, because there's a legal ramification that's bad, but there's a spiritual ramification that's even worse. We go on from there to talk about a piece of news in the Catholic Herald that was brought to my attention. A well-known Italian Catholic priest has millions of views, hundreds of thousands of followers across multiple social media platforms. He recently announced that he wants to leave the priesthood, Italian Father Alberto Ravagnani. And he's clashed with his diocese before over some of his online content, but there are issues here that are greater. There's a deeper moral problem here, and that's that for a while now, he's been pulling back. He's been pulling away from the honest identification with his priesthood. And so a lot of his content has to do with self-care, skin care, supplements, working out. And in all of this, it's very clear that he has moved from, and also the eradication of his priestly garb, because he claims that anything clerical stops him from connecting with the people. And so it's not a surprise, but I want to talk about the phenomena. This is not a condemnation of priests or bishops who utilize social media to get their message out. And this is why. These are Roman roads. They are good. The problem with the social media outlet as a whole is that one can be tempted to start thinking that the platform is one's identity. And I believe that's what's happened here. And so I want to talk about that psychological phenomena. There's Bishop Robert Barron, Father Mike Schmitz, Father John Ricardo, great men on these platforms and doing a tremendous amount of good. Then finally, we speak with Brian Cranley about how the God of reason created science in his image. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, February 4th. It's the Feast of St. Joseph of Leonessa. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Pope Leo is warning of the dangers of a new global arms race. Speaking at the conclusion of his general audience today, he referenced the expiration of a nuclear weapons treaty between the U.S. and Russia that is set to expire tomorrow, and urged the world leaders not to allow the agreement to lapse without a credible and effective alternative, and recalled that the 2010 treaty represented a significant step in limiting the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Nuclear talks between Iran and the U.S. appear to be collapsing, according to reports from Axios. The breakdown comes after Iran and the U.S. disagreed on where to have the next talks. Two U.S. officials told Axios the two nations agreed to meet in Istanbul with other Middle Eastern countries participating as observers, but Tehran wanted to change the format to a bilateral meeting in Oman, which was ultimately rejected by Washington. Border Czar Tom Holman says hundreds of federal agents are being pulled out of Minnesota immediately as ICE operations continue. He says this comes as there have been a significant progress made with Minnesota officials.
Again, a complete drawdown is going to depend on cooperation, continued cooperation of local and state law enforcement, and the decrease of the violence, the rhetoric, and the attacks against ICE and Border Patrol.
Holman said coordination with local officials helps keep the community safe by keeping criminals off the street. Some events in the 2026 Winter Olympics will get a head start today. The opening ceremonies for the Winter Games in Milan, Italy, aren't until Friday, but the first events for the Games got underway today, including alpine skiing training, luge training, and curling. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Last Sunday at City East Church in St. Paul, Minnesota, worshippers opened their Bibles and began to pray, and it was not part of a planned service. This was their response to an anti-ICE mob that had stormed into their sanctuary, disrupting their constitutional right to worship freely. So it's not an isolated incident. It is part of a beginning disturbing trend and pattern. Andrea Picciotti-Bayer joins us. She is legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. You can follow her work at conscience-project.org. Andrea, thank you very much for making the time. How are you?
I'm doing well, Marcus. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I love this piece you put out in the Daily Caller. I'm very thankful that you did. Like you rightly note, this is an emerging pattern. And I've been thinking long and hard about the fact that we as a republic have lost the notion of reverence for due worship owed to God.
No, absolutely. And whether it's attacks of vandalism or shootings in churches, or in the case of what happened on the 18th of January, actually disturbing a worship service, there's a troubling trend that's attacking and chipping away at the basic notion of religious freedom. You know, obviously, religious freedom is much more than just the right to worship, but its core and central part should be protecting the right to worship. And it's very shameful that people aren't more across the aisles up in arms.
The issue we're also facing, like you mentioned, shameful that not more people are up in arms, but if I may press the issue further, it's also that people don't even see what's really wrong with this, that this is such an affront to a fundamental order of justice that man ought to worship God.
No, absolutely. You know, I think that some of it may be a reflection, Marcus, of the fact that more and more Americans are unchurched.
Mm.
You know, they're not familiar with sacred spaces and don't see the difference between a church and a big box store. You know, it's just a place in which lots of people gather. There's also kind of a troubling trend that's rejecting the rule of law. You know, there's a federal law, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which is used to protect people who are protesting from interfering with people's entrance into abortion clinics. It also includes houses of worship. So it's not only attacking our First Amendment right to religious freedom, but is specifically a violation of a federal law. And that was a law that was passed, you know, back in the 90s. And how things have changed. You know, obviously, this is one of the first times that it's actually been enforced to protect houses of worship. And I think that that's very important, and that we celebrate the administration's enforcement of the law in this context. But it's also very interesting that people would be up in arms if a similar kind of protest happened in other settings that are maybe more favorable to left-leaning causes. But because this was a church that's particularly, I guess it's labeled, I don't know how you label a church conservative or politically conservative. It's just a church, but politically conservative, that it was fair grounds for people to go in there and disrupt. And we really need to, I was reading earlier today, Marcus, the indictment against the 9 individuals that have been arrested and charged for violating federal law. And it's really quite frightening. The brazen and aggressive attack. These weren't just people protesting outside a church, which is still kind of low class, but these are people going in and confronting worshipers, confronting their pastor, and intimidating, and even being aggressive with children.
I'm really glad you brought up the FACE Act and its proper application in this front. My friend Adam Wright was texting me about it, and you and I have spoken about this in the past, and unfortunately, the memory of the act has left a bad taste in my mouth, because we saw how previous administrations weaponized that act against, for example, pro-life advocates and therefore Christians in fighting for life in the womb.
No, absolutely. As a young lawyer many years ago, Marcus, I was in the office of the Civil Rights Division, and one of the laws that my office enforced was FACE. And at the time, I went to my boss and said, look, this is something that I just think may cause problems with my belief of the sanctity of life, mm-hmm. and was allowed to focus on enforcement of the other laws. But it was very clear even then that this was politically charged against pro-life activists. And obviously, anyone that brings violence, it doesn't matter what your cause is. Our laws are there to guard against violence and to make sure to keep the peace. But there were cases in which people were, like you said, peaceful protesters outside of clinics, and they were being investigated and prosecuted. These are not that peaceful protesters who were staging, a concerted, planned attack on the congregants and their spiritual leader, going into a church and using, they didn't use weapons, but they sure did use very strong language that would intimidate and chill the freedom that people felt inside their house of worship.
And that's exactly it. Within a house of worship, there ought to be a ubiquitous understanding of sanctuary, and therefore, even if you don't recognize a sacred space, at least a constitutional rights space.
No, absolutely. And the piece that you mentioned earlier, Marcus, I even included, people may disagree with me, but I don't believe that ICE enforcement is appropriate inside of churches, mm-hmm. either. So this isn't being, one side of the very difficult debate that we have going on related to immigration of enforcement. This is about the sanctity of our houses of worship. And I think that it should not just be a bipartisan issue. It should be a nonpartisan issue. It should be an American issue, because this is where people come to have that intimate personal relationship with their Creator, to gather as a community. And if people are worried about violence, vandalism, arson, we've seen in the past that different houses of worship have been attacked, whether it's by the Klan or in this case, these anti-ICE protesters. This is really un-American. Mm-hmm. And to confuse it as being a tension between two First Amendment rights, the right to protest and the right to worship, it's just not. These aren't two conflicting rights. There is a sacred right to worship. And what these people that interfered were doing, they weren't protesting, they were intimidating.
And therefore, you brought up Don Lemon in your piece, and I'm glad you did, because the reason justice is being, or at the very least, the reason he's being looked at is not because he's a journalist. This has nothing to do with freedom of journalism. This is because a constitutional right, and therefore a right of the individual to worship God, was violated, and therefore something criminal has happened.
No, absolutely. And at least from the indictment that was said, it does show much more complicit collaboration with the leaders of the protest or of the altercation, and not kind of a standby, a bystander that was observing things. But he, while he was live streaming, purposely keeping information away from those that were watching as to where they were going, where they were heading, and saying repeatedly, I won't divulge where we're heading, and that adds a level of complicity. Now, these are going to have to be, whether there's a trial or whether there's some sort of negotiations, the details are going to come more. But just because you have a journalist badge or a camera doesn't give you access to violate the Constitution, and that's the harder thing. As we have more and more of these kind of amateur journalists or mm-hmm. independent journalists, they don't have the same ethics that the established mainstream outlets have, as far as respecting the rule of law and the safety of people, especially when we're dealing with young children. That I just felt was very, very shocking.
And one thing you point out, too, is this incident, amongst others, is proving very clearly that it is the Christian faith that makes people a target. So we'll continue these conversations in the future. Andrea, thank you for your time.
Marcus, thank you so much. Have a great evening.
My guest has been Andrea Picciotti-Bear, and she's been talking about the vandalizing churches, disrupting services, and progressives' attack on religious freedom. Her piece in the Daily Caller warrants a read. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the following nonprofit, Christendom College.
Each summer, hundreds of high school juniors come to Christendom College for the best week ever. A week-long experience of classes in philosophy, literature, history, and theology, daily mass and adoration, activities like canoeing, debating, dancing, and bonfires in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Students leave with a deeper appreciation for the liberal arts and lasting friendships that stay with them long after the weekend ends. Learn more at thebestweekever.com.
This program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit research and educational institute.
This Lent, join Catholics across the country starting on Ash Wednesday, February 18th, for Bible Across America, a nationwide study on the practical relevance of the Bible for our daily lives as we prepare to celebrate the resurrection of our Lord on Easter Sunday. Spearheaded by our sponsor, the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, with some of today's leading Catholic voices. To learn more, visit stpaulcenter.com/Ave. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. A priest in Milan just announced that he's stepping away from priestly ministry. This piece was highlighted in the Catholic Herald. And the headlines, of course, immediately drag us as readers through things like personality, platform size, optics, and the usual social media outrage. And the reason why is simple. This priest is a what one might call a social media influencer. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on his numerous social media platforms and sponsorship deals as well. The issue we are seeing here is deeper. I want to make clear. Just because someone is on social media, especially priests, bishops, that doesn't mean that therefore they have fallen into this rut that I'm about to speak about. Instead, what I want to highlight is that these social media platforms really are the new Roman roads. And I sincerely believe that if Paul was alive today, he would be on all of these platforms in an extremely active manner, putting out the gospel as much as he can, as effectively as he can. At the same time, there are issues that these platforms do present, and that's what I want to talk about. Because the more revealing story here has less to do with what the priest is doing on social media and what social media can do to a person who lives inside it long enough, especially in a public role or a spiritual vocation. The human person can sometimes confuse their witness of the gospel with their performance on social media. And therefore, they can mistake their social media community with a real audience of the gospel. And then they'll water down their pastoral presence. Because at the end of the day, it has more to do with a managed public brand. And if that confusion takes over the soul, then it really is social media algorithms that drive the ministry, not the other way around. Social media offers an appealing bargain. Don't get me wrong. Even I can acknowledge it. It allows an individual to define their existence in a very curated way. You can present what ostensibly in your mind is your best self on these platforms. And with a lot of ease, too. Just change your lighting, change your presentation, change your wording. But what social media never shows is the hard work of living that life beyond the platform. And that you can't edit away. A platform, a social media platform, is a very small mirror of the fullness of a person's life. But the problem is this mirror is alluring. It speaks back to you in statistics and numbers and comments and likes. And so it teaches the psyche to place your personal meaning in your social media audience, because meaning is measurable there. It's numerical. And if you don't guard yourself, then the human person learns to treat social media approval as proof of the fact that this is what's true, rather than understanding that sometimes you'll preach the truth even if you don't get a huge following for it. And of course, when you speak to such individuals, especially those who have traded in this case, their integrity for the sake of their social media following, they're just, quote unquote, reaching the people. Or as one particular social media influencer who claims to be conservative says, that she is just the voice of the people. So this priest, for example, to quote from the article in Catholic Herald, as he kept using his platform and it kept growing, he began to wear civilian clothes and film himself in civilian clothes. And he explained that he had to be willing to give up the uniform, the priestly garb, the clerical collar, to get close to people. Now, Fulton Sheen powerfully reminded us during his public service and public ministry, the priest is not his own. He is for the church. He is for the flock of Jesus Christ. And that's why when you go back to these platforms, their structure rewards a particular kind of psychological position. The self, the individual, becomes social media content. And so what happens is the mind begins to narrate one's life as a sequence of moments that will hopefully land to trigger response. And what that does is it trains the individual to think a certain way, to act a certain way, and to talk a certain way. So much so that if we don't guard ourselves, we start thinking of our existence as only within these platforms and our entire life as being what we put forth in these platforms. It's like the social media content creator is watching his own life on the screen. And that's the only way they know about their life. And that's why one's identity can become a social media campaign. Relationships are reduced to social media networking. Interior life just becomes a prop. When the camera appears, you have an interior life. And when the camera disappears, your interior life is on the screen. Older thinkers have so much to teach us, like pre-social media thinkers. Irving Goffman, for example, he describes social life as a kind of presentation. People manage their impressions of self before others. Now, the problem is social media intensifies that logic, because now it's not just individuals you're speaking to, you're constantly on stage in the digital sphere. Charles Horton Cooley came up with this phrase, the looking glass self. It's the self that you see, in this case, in the screen as opposed to the mirror, and that's the self that you constantly want to put forth. But really, the greatest amount of wisdom that I've found comes from Cal Newport in his book Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. And he states the problem very clearly. He says this, if our phone is always in our presence, it takes away the ability to be present. So we may sit at dinner, but our minds might remain elsewhere. We may stand at Mass, but our attention just wanders because we are used to not just a few impulses, but thousands of constant micro impulses. So much so that we might even be speaking to friends. But privately, we are imagining different scenarios, especially those that play out online. So Cal Newman would go on to say, the more time you spend connecting, in air quotes, on these devices, the more isolated you're likely to become. We can accumulate a sense of being surrounded, but quietly losing the ability to sustain real relationships, especially real relationships that require things like patience, forgiveness, investment, humility, time. And so the person can begin to prefer the controllable contact of social media followers rather than the intimacy of real human relationships, because real relationships are difficult, they're messy, and there's no attention economy. You are dealing with an individual who has needs, issues, but also has a capacity for real love that you need to pour into selflessly. That's why at the psychological level, it's easy if we live on social media to become disingenuous. Now, this starts off as an accident for a lot of people, but eventually it becomes a strategy of living. A social media persona can start off with good intentions, like I mentioned, and then they can start wearing a mask, and then that mask becomes their face. And then worse, if the face becomes profitable in that way, money, status, influence, affirmation. And that status, that social media presence, starts exerting moral pressure. The person lives the persona that they put forth. And so a person may start to protect the image that they put forth more than the real self. So much so they might even forget what the real self is before God, in honesty, the acknowledgement of our sinfulness and our brokenness. And that's why that priestly angle matters so much. I'm a husband and a father. If I were to go on social media and to put forth content, at the end of the day, I go home to be a husband and a father. But for a priest, for someone who's in religious life, their life is for everyone. They've given their lives for everyone. And so there really is a temptation. And so praise God for those priests and bishops that utilize social media in a virtuous manner and who pray against the allure of celebrity, so much so that their utilization of these platforms don't take away from the bond they have with Christ and the fullness of truth that they live in Him. Unfortunately for this young Italian priest, that's what happened. And so he's leaving, but he has a following that's humongous, and it's going to keep growing. Cal Newport, once again, from that book, Digital Minimalism. How much of your time and attention must be sacrificed to earn the small profit of occasional connection and new ideas that is earned by cultivating a significant presence on Twitter? Or any other platform, for that matter. In this sense, I exhort you, touch grass. And I mean this without being crude here. No, reconnect with reality. The more we are online, the less we are connected with reality. And the more we detach from the online world, the more we are connected with reality. Utilize social media for the good that it has. Utilize it for the tool that it is. But let's be grounded in reality, where our self finds meaning in God. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The first commandment: I am the Lord your God. You shall have no strange gods before me. In this commandment, God seeks to protect us from false claims to our worship and obedience. And there's a great sad history of people who have trusted in gods other than him or things other than him, and the ruin that it has caused. So God is trying to protect us and call us to an absolute trust and obedience of him. He asks us to trust him above all things and above all other people or so-called gods. We have to also avoid things like consulting horoscopes, palm reading, clairvoyance, recourse to mediums, any desire to try to control things apart from God. God simply says, trust me, I'm the Lord your God. The first commandment, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no strange gods before me.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament, with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me and he says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, these are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master, and the Master is Jesus.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. For centuries now, people have been told that they must choose, believe in God or trust in science. But we all know that the Catholic Church has made very clear both paths were designed to lead to the same truth. God is the author of both the books of nature and Revelation. Wonder is the key that bridges them. Brian Cranley joins us to talk about this. Brian is the author of The Call of Wonder, How the God of Reason Created Science in His Image. Throughout his life, Brian has been fascinated by the intersection of God and the real world, and this led him to learn a BS in biomedical engineering from Texas A&M University and later a Master's of Divinity from the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. Brian, great to speak with you. How are you?
Marcus, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, very glad to speak with you. And this is a topic I dialogue quite a bit with and about, so I'm really glad to see many other people talking about this. Let's begin with the central claim of your book, that I think it's easy for us to think that science came along and therefore disproved religion. But the truth is, this whole science against faith debate is a very new historical phenomena.
Yes, and I would say the Catholic Church does the best job of bridging the two together. In my own life, I just struggled because I had on one side the degree in engineering. I love science naturally, and I kind of gravitate towards deep space and the new discoveries. And then on the other side, I have the Master's of Divinity, and I really loved the religious philosophy of Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, and the theology that the Church has built on top of that. And so for a long time, I, in my own mind, just felt like they really weren't compatible. I never expected them to come together. But then upon closer inspection, there's some fascinating interplay between the two. And I think the Church does a great job of bringing them together.
And in fact, the most expansive responses for this issue and this question has always come from the Church and nowhere else.
Yeah.
And I think, therefore, that presents the other criticism that of all of the religious institutions, it's always modernity against the Catholic Church, which is a horrendous lie.
Right. Yeah. Because you see throughout history, it's the Catholic Church that started the universities and sort of backed the sciences, really started the sciences and has supported them throughout history. And so, yeah, like you said, it's a modern phenomenon with, I guess, modern materialist atheism and sort of making this new push of, faith versus science. But really, the Catholic Church never saw it that way. It's always been one truth, stemming from one source, which is God.
From there, reading your book, it's very clear that you present a particular tool as the way in which to bridge this conversation, and that's wonder. Tell us about how to understand wonder correctly. And then secondly, what has happened to the concept of wonder today?
Yeah, great question. So I thought about this for a long time. What is wonder? And I came up with three different forms of wonder. And two of them are very prevalent in modern society. The first one being this sort of CGI movies and social media blasts where you create this sort of artificial type of wonder that hits quick, gets you a dopamine rush, and then it goes away. A second form of wonder is imaginative wonder, where you're imagining a future, you're imagining stories. You see this in children and adults too. But the third type is what I really wanted to focus in on. And in the book, I call it authentic wonder. And I say it's this wonder that comes about from being present to larger realities outside yourself, such as the beauty of nature, the existence of God, and, you know, philosophy, theology, and deep space, these things that are larger than you. And that authentic wonder brings you this sort of humbling stillness experience. And I think I'm thinking about this more and more, but I think, you know, we need that as a culture to heal our minds from all this other stuff that's going on through them. But this natural wonder in the world that God created, I think, has a really healing force.
And in order to have proper wonder, you need to be able to think rightly. And so the question here is reason. But even before we get there, what has happened to our reason? What has happened to our wonder? Why is the average man lost in a sense of awe? We no longer have it as a natural part of our thinking.
Good question. You know, once I read Plato and Aristotle, or I was, you know, taught in school, you kind of get this sense of a lot of modern society, I feel like we've gone backwards in our reason because people didn't have all these distractions, but we're just a really distracted society. You know, we have television, phones, internet, there's constant entertainment to the point of you don't give your reason a chance to work and just experience God's presence in nature. We don't have as much time for that. We really have to guard our time, make time outside, take time to study some things that might be a little more difficult and not, you know, immediately enjoyable, but they lead to, like you said, this substance to think about. And I think it really enhances your quality of life when you do that.
And therefore, that leads us to that question, then, how to think about reason rightly. In other words, how to think about thinking rightly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the church, where I received it, I would never have found any of this on my own if I hadn't gone to philosophy and theology and the Masters of Divinity program. But the church has really sort of safeguarded this right thinking and has, you know, the whole tradition of Western religious philosophy and theology that's gone on for centuries, the church has safeguarded that. And when we had, you know, Catholic education that was much more prevalent, people would get this as regular education. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it's a lot less common. You know, places like Ave Maria and Steubenville are trying to, you know, continue that tradition. But what I did in the first half of my book was try to summarize the Catholic seminarians get called pre-theology, where you get that history of religious philosophy. It's summarized in four chapters in the first half of the book for those people that might not have a chance to get that education.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, it is a deviation from what we would historically call a classical mode of thinking. So before I ask you to touch on the classical mode of thinking, the common criticism is that, well, you know, that's antiquated. That was before material science, and so we shouldn't use that anymore. What's the response to that?
Well, I think it's parts of ancient philosophy are antiquated, but parts are very prevalent today. Like, you still have discussions of virtue that stem from Aristotle, and they're extremely practical. Like, they're still of use today. And one of the things I talk about in my book is, you know, some of these realities are timeless. I'm thinking of like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. These virtues and values that are what we believe are coming from God, they're timeless and they apply to every culture. And so the ancients were tuned into real life just like we are today. So I think there's a real practical value for studying this stuff.
Now, the merit of studying this stuff, therefore, opens the door for us to present certain names. And you do present certain names. The big ones are Aristotle, Aquinas. Can you talk about why you picked those names? What is it that they have to teach us today?
Sure. I start off the book with a discussion between Plato and Aristotle. And Plato begins the great conversation of understanding God through human reason. And the reason why I started with Plato and why I think the church does as well is because he presents this argument for, can invisible things like beauty, truth, goodness, can these things have real existence? And the reason why that conversation is important is because atheist materialists would say, no, they don't have real existence. But if you want to arrive at an immaterial God, you need to have this discussion on immaterial realities. And Plato provides that structure. And then Aristotle builds off him to come up with an even more sort of precise order to the universe. And then the reason why that discussion is so important was because St. Augustine built a lot of his philosophy and theology off of Plato, and Thomas Aquinas built a lot of his theology and philosophy off of Aristotle. And so a lot of people don't realize that this Greek philosophical conversation underlies a lot of our Catholic theology. And so I start with Plato and Aristotle. I even go through the Islamic philosophers because Aquinas used them and his philosophy and theology. But that's to arrive at how Thomas Aquinas comes up with these attributes of God.
Yeah. My guest is Brian Cranley. He's the author most recently of The Call of Wonder, published by Greenleaf Book Group Press. And it's about how the God of reason created science in his image. He is the source of science and divine revelation. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
Steve and Janet Ray here, inviting you to join us in Portugal, Spain, and France as we follow the three children of Fatima and Saint Bernadette of Lourdes and encounter lots of surprises along the way. These moving apparition sights never fail to inspire awe, healing, and a love for Our Lady, exquisite countryside, and our Spanish chaplain, Father Alfonso Aguilar.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
What is the great mystery of the Christian faith? It is, of course, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Even though the resurrection is an historical fact professed by the apostles and signified by the empty tomb, no one knows the exact hour Jesus emerged from the tomb. There were no eyewitnesses to describe the actual moment, only the result, the live appearances of Jesus to his disciples. It is an event that transcends and surpasses history, the Catholic Catechism tells us. The three persons of the Trinity, using their individual characteristics, acted as one in bringing about the resurrection. God the Father raised up the Son. God the Holy Spirit gave life to Jesus' dead humanity and called it to the glorious state of lordship. The Son effects his own resurrection by virtue of his divine power. He predicted the Passion and declared that he had the power to lay down his life and take it up again. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
She was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, speaking with Brian Cranley, the author of The Call of Wonder. And it's a conversation about science and the faith with this question of wonder as the bridge that connects the gaps. So Brian, to pick up where we had left off, like you were mentioning earlier, St. Thomas Aquinas draws from a tremendous amount of resources outside of the Christian tradition to prove that the God who gave us divine revelation is also the God behind all truth, wherever truth might be found across the world.
Yes, Thomas Aquinas, in my book, I hone in, he has these philosophical divine attributes of God. And in my book, I hone in on the attributes of God as one, God is infinite, God is eternal, and God is mystery or unknowable or not completely knowable. And so what I try to do in the second half of the book is take what Thomas Aquinas offers from philosophy, from this thousand-year conversation of philosophy, and it makes the claim that you can find these attributes in modern science. And so in the development of the universe, in the development of life on Earth, and in specifically the human mind, you can see these attributes of God's oneness, God's infinity, God's eternity, and God's mystery.
One of the things that you attempt in the second part of the book is to present the three miracles, but you present it as analogies for the faith. And so before we even tackle that, I think it's important for us to understand why it is difficult and impossible to use material science to prove the existence of God, rightly speaking. Help us understand why.
Yeah, so materialist science, if you look at it, you're gonna encounter these problems. And I try to read a lot of atheist science books just to hear their opinion on things. And I remember reading Krauss's book, A Universe from Nothing, which tries to make the argument for ex nihilo creation from nothing. But the problem they get into is it's impossible. Like for creation to just pop out of nowhere, there had to have been pre-existing empty space with negatively charged gravity. And the problem with that is that's not really what the science shows. And similarly, if you look at the atheist description of how life on Earth sort of evolved through chemical evolution, these non-living constituent parts floating in the ocean with an energy source, and then they come together to make the first cell, the problem with that is you can't recreate it in a lab. Still today, we know a pretty good idea of what those constituent parts were, but we can't do it. Same thing with the human mind. You come up with, you know, we know brain biology, we know psychology, we know neuroscience pretty well, but we still, the mind and the human intellect is a complete mystery to us still. And so I call these the three miracles of science because they're unexplainable at a certain level. Like we hit a wall with our reason and we can't go there. We can learn all about it. We can learn a lot. We continue to learn more, but there's a wall you hit. And my whole point in the book is that is exactly what God's essence is. When you study God, you can know more about him forever. You can continually learn more, but you will always hit a wall of unknowing because he is infinitely greater than us.
And that wall of unknowing is the place where awe and humility ought to begin. And I think that's a good segue into looking at questions like, say, the Great Expansion, the Big Bang, or even the concept of the evolution of life if we work the intellectual exercise of it, and the mystery of the human mind.
Yeah, so the wall of unknowing. I'll start with, I'll share with how the idea for the book came around, because it kind of has to do with that. So I had this education in engineering and space, and then I had this education in philosophy and theology, and I was kind of holding them separate in my mind. And then one day I watched a YouTube video from Fermilab on the first moments of time, you know, as far as science is discovering from things like the Large Hadron Collider. And what it said was, at time equals 10 to the negative 43, which is about as far back as we can go, which is, you know, a blink of an eye, less than that, matter and energy were one and the same thing. And so all the matter in the universe was one and the same. And the way they described it was also that the four forces of physics might also have been one and the same. And they're talking about this unity in the early universe. And that's when it hit me that the way scientists are talking about the first moment of time sounds exactly like the way philosophers like Aquinas talked about God's essence in the Doctrine of the Divine Simplicity. And then they talked about how science can't go back. The laws of physics break down if you try to go back to time equals zero, because time didn't exist. And so there's all these singularities that happen in our physics. They break down. So there's this great mystery that we can go back almost to it, but we can't get there, you know? And it just sounded exactly like how the philosophers talk about God. So that was kind of the origin. That great mystery was kind of the origin of the book.
And that great mystery therefore prompts us to a deeper consideration, because on the one hand, you can look at science, but on the other hand, there's a validity to the scriptures and it being the word of God. So before we talk about what the scriptures can teach us, one thing that you do is also to tackle the fact that the scriptures are believable because they themselves are a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk about in chapter 9, I talk about specifically, it's a whole chapter about the scriptures, and it's really just Genesis, the first Genesis creation account and the second Genesis creation account. And we talk about how, you know, there's argument within Christianity as to how literal you should take Genesis. And I read one of Pope Benedict's books, I think it was In the Beginning, and he talks about how, like, ultra-literal interpretations are kind of like a slavery of the mind, and that we really have to look at what the author was like, what time period the author was writing in, and how the Holy Spirit was working through them. And so I talk a lot about how just because Genesis 1 is Near East Mesopotamian ancient poetry doesn't mean it's not communicating truth. It just means that truth is packaged in a different way. And so if you're trying to read it like a textbook or a history book, you're going to miss the main points of it. And so I talk a lot about that as mystery, but also it's still the divine revelation.
And that divine revelation, when we understand that rightly, as you point out, becomes the illuminating power for even our scientific inquiry. It gives us answers for how to think about the created order in the material world.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's also where the power of needing the church's interpretive authority comes in, because you see people going, you know, far literal, way too, you know, non-literal, but the church gives you these boundaries to stay in, which is really beautiful. So that's what I did when I started the book. I researched, what does the church teach about Genesis, creation, and what is that range that we're allowed to believe as Catholics? And then I wanted to stay within that range. And, you know, I think of G.K. Chesterton talked about a playground analogy. If you had like a small island with 100-foot cliffs all around it, and you had a playground in the middle with kids, the kids would stay just in the very middle of the playground if there was no fence. But if you add a fence with a boundary, then the kids could play all over the yard. And so I think of that analogy a lot when I'm trying to, you know, pray and consider these really difficult topics on science and faith, and how far can you go this way and that way. The church really is what we need to maintain that boundary.
And I'm really glad to hear you mention that, because effectively what you're also showing is that with the church, with following the voice and the wisdom of the church, everyone, that's one thing that came out in your book, everyone, by virtue of being baptized, is called to understand this, to see this harmony between faith and reason, and that there's really no dichotomy here.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%, which is what I'm hoping this book will do, is offer the main ideas throughout history for both philosophy, theology, and then science. All I really did was compile these sort of main ideas from these major thinkers. And what I'm hoping it'll be, I originally wrote it as a tool of evangelization for people that, either have left the faith or are leaving the faith because they just genuinely love science.
Yeah.
And they weren't given this rational side to the faith that is so deep within the Catholic Church. If they never got that, sometimes it's really hard to reconcile faith and science. And so I was trying to provide that for people as a quick, you know, overview summary so people could have that. But also just to let people know there's no need to fear science either. Mm. We can look into science as far as you want to go, and you're not going to all of a sudden disprove God. You know, an authentic atheist will tell you they can't disprove God, and we might not be able to definitively prove God, but I feel like you can come pretty close. But I feel like everyone has that responsibility to research and make their own decisions on it.
I love that you shared that, and so I want to invite you to share the converse as well, which is we also therefore shouldn't fear theology and philosophy to the extent that we can engage it, use it, because God has made it for all of us, so that we can find the truth about creation and Him.
Yeah, and I keep thinking of this quote from Frank Sheed, where he talks about theology as an inexhaustible well that you can revisit time and time again, and it's constant water for the soul. So if people are afraid of philosophy and theology, like you said, then they're really missing out on a beautiful addition to their spiritual life and their mental life. Like it just gives you substance to think about during the day.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. It's substance to think about during the day. It's like it's like food for the soul, food for the intellect. Well,
100%.
Brian, I really enjoyed this conversation, and I also greatly enjoyed your book. It's very beautifully written, very accessible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
My guest has been Brian Cranley. He is the author of The Call of Wonder, How the God of Reason Created Science in His Image. It's a very well-written book, and I'm a lover of books, so I'm going to recommend it greatly. Sit down, think about the way we ought to be thinking about science and the faith, and don't be afraid. That's one big exhortation I want to offer everyone listening. Don't be afraid to look into science, and don't be afraid to look into theology and philosophy, and know that the God of the universe authored both. And He wants you, because He's your author, to examine all of this so that you can know creation and know Him. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.